This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 76 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. In today's episode, we have Julian Wolf on Kinky Education. Here's your hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thanks, Max, and welcome back to another edition of the Kinky Cast. As usual, across the desk is the Beast. How you doing, man?
I am doing wonderful. I had two wonderful days with a 21-year-old submissive.
Oh, man. It must be a tough life, huh?
Yes, yes. Well, actually, I'm feeling rather tired.
Oh, poor baby. Well, you have to work tonight because we have an important guest.
Oh, we are in luck tonight. Got a person here from what I think may be the kinkiest city in the United States.
You mean San Francisco, of course.
No, Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Oh, come on.
I think per capita, Albuquerque has more kinky people than San Francisco.
Okay, now that's saying something.
Julian, you are on the line with us. What do you think?
I think it kind of depends on where you look. We do have quite a few kinky people, and Fet Life has certainly brought a lot of them out. I go to San Francisco pretty frequently, so I might say per capita we might be close, but because our population's so low, we all know each other, and we all wind up doing the same stuff.
And with us tonight is Julian Wolf, and I'm going to go with her short bio, and her longer bio will be on the website. Julian is an educator, wordsmith, performer, an active participant in the alternative scene in the Southwest and beyond. And I'll give her website here, and we'll give it a couple more signs, www.julianwolf.net. Thank you for being with us, Julian.
Thank you. And just so everyone knows, my Facebook gets updated a lot more than my website. And my pro page on Facebook is facebook.com/professionaljulian.
Fantastic.
We will pull those out and get those on our hot links page, which is just a list of web links. You are quite a diverse individual.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'd say I'm looking at the bio and it's like,
yes, you are a artist, a performer, an educator, a kinkster. What else have we missed in there?
Let's see. I'm a pretty good cook as well, and I have managed a couple of households in my time, and I probably would have to look at my list too. I'm a poet. I've been locally published mostly.
Wow. You are incredibly active in the regional and national communities now. You sit on the NCSF Board of Directors, I believe, don't you?
Yeah, I've been elected 3 times so far.
3 times?
Yes, I was really honored. They usually do a trial period for people that are new to the board. I actually was elected for my first term. They didn't give me the nominated position. I've been volunteering for quite some time, so I felt I was ready to go ahead and be put to vote.
You have been out in kinky for about half of your life now.
That's true.
Yeah, but your journey effectively started very early. When you were, what, 7 years old?
Absolutely. Let me actually give you a little bit of background on that. I remember as early as 7 running around saying, my parents only had 1 son, but they raised 2 gentlemen. My brother was actually younger than me. I knew from early on I wanted to be more like my dad than anybody else. And I started taking the fact that he is a gentleman really seriously and started trying to emulate that, even when I was running around with ringlet curls as a little kid.
What was that like growing up for the next 11, 12 years until you reached adulthood and actually entered the community?
I spent a lot of time in church. I come from a really conservative, very Christian upbringing. But the cool part is that my mom never got to be a tomboy like she wanted to when she was a little kid. And her mother always discouraged her from hanging out with the boys. So it was kind of a rebellious thing for her to let me have all the guy friends and run around and do more of the stuff that was that stereotypically guy stuff. So it never really became a big issue. While I never really got along with the other girls and didn't really go to slumber parties, I was more likely to get invited to go do the stuff with the guys, including setting stuff on fire behind the church, like you do. I didn't see a big discrepancy for me personally, because I was able to pull off dressing up and looking nice on Sunday mornings. So I just always have felt like a boy. And while I didn't have language for it, it kind of, that specific part didn't really mess with me too much as a kid.
So boys do have more fun, is that correct?
They have different types of fun. And I do not understand the mysteries of women. And I really did not grow up like a stereotypical teenage girl in my area in any way. So I think it's different types of fun and different types of mysteries.
Now, when you turned over into your late teens, you just jumped into all this. What sparked the realization about kink?
Two things. My first boyfriend, who is fabulous and wonderful, and we're still friends. We've been broken up for well over a decade. He and I explored pretty much everything we could possibly explore. The first time we dated for 9 months and didn't have traditional, how most people traditionally define sex that entire time, but we were missing class because we were so busy enjoying each other in my dorm room. He was my first boyfriend, but he was also my first girlfriend because we started role-playing fairly early on, and I was his first boyfriend. And we just thoroughly enjoyed each other in so many different ways. And then, pretty quickly, I think after we broke up, and we broke up and then started having sex about 2 months later, because I negotiated with him that I wanted my first love to also be the first person I had actual sex with. And he said, this doesn't mean we're getting back together. And I said, oh, no, I don't want to get back together. I just want to have sex. And so that's how that got negotiated.
That's kind of backwards to a lot of things out there.
Yeah, but it worked for us.
Okay.
I got picked up at a goth bar by a woman who'd been involved in the scene for quite some time. And after our first date, she collared me.
Wow.
A first date collaring. Wow.
Yeah, that's not smart, and I don't recommend it. She's actually a big part of the reason that I started in Mexico, The Next Generation, in MTNG just a few years later, because I didn't want anyone else to kind of make some of the mistakes that I made. This woman had been a former title holder and also was an educator. So when she said something like, we don't need to negotiate, I said, I disbelieved her because she knew what she was talking about because she was a teacher and a former title holder. We were actually together for about 2.5 years. It taught me a lot about how not to do dominant submissive dynamics.
That was definitely a coloring period of your life then, I'm sure. And that was way back before we started talking about these things like negotiations as a commonplace occurrence in somebody entering the community. Nowadays, that's common conversation about negotiations and sub-frenzy and such topics. But then it was a bit less commonly talked about.
Yeah, it's true. I actually helped her teach the first class I ever went to. It was a BDSM 101 class that she had me help teach with her. And she absolutely talked about negotiation and checking references and all of that. I just was told that we were above such things.
And nobody's above it.
Oh, no. I did learn a lot from that relationship that I'm very grateful for, and I met some cool people. We did a lot of traveling, and even though it didn't end well, I'm grateful for the parts that were positive.
You jumped in with both feet, and you had a title within, what, 3 or 4 years of that?
About, yeah. That was the second title I ever ran for. The first time I didn't win, and that is okay. And I do this because I wasn't familiar with how everything worked as well, and I spent the year between that kind of learning and training and trying to grow a little bit more. We've had a history of title holders in New Mexico for decades. We're one of the older states that's been actively doing mother. But I was the first one to hold the title of Ms. Rio Grandmother. And it was a really interesting year because we had to organize the event ourselves about a month out. The people that had been doing events in New Mexico, the Black Leather Weekend, lived in Colorado, and they had to bow out because of a terrible family emergency about a month before we were going to have this big event. And our community came together and we organized the event and basically took it over. And I was on the organization team. So I wound up running the show Friday night and then competing Saturday.
That was a crash course, wasn't it?
Well, quite frankly, I was chicken hawk. but I was chicken hawked by somebody that also performed and taught. So at my very first other event ever, they had to change the age of the entire event so I could go, because previously it had been 21 and over, and I wasn't 21 yet. We performed two or three fantasies in the fantasy show, and we taught two or three classes. So it was just normal for me. Oh, and we volunteered. I also volunteered. I ran the desk for a few hours. So that's just how it was. And so it wasn't above and beyond what I was used to doing, but it was a little bit scary, because volunteering or organizing or even producing is completely different than being literally judged in front of people. I guess the other positive thing is the first year that I ran for a title and didn't win, Judy Tolling McCarthy was one of my judges, the first Enzel. I already knew how to be very intimidated by somebody who has such an incredible life in leather, that the second time I went and I was more prepared, it wasn't as scary.
If there's one title, you actually went for a smaller title a couple of years later, the Miss New Mexico Pride.
Yeah, and I don't know that it was smaller, because it's just a completely different organization. The Rio Grande Leather was a new title, technically regional, but we were so new, all of the travel and whatnot that we did was 100%. By the way, I do want to mention Ruben Gallegos. Daddy Ruben was the first Mr. Rio Grande Leather, and we very much did that title year together. We took that really seriously. But back to the New Mexico Pride title, that one was very different. It was very performance-based and very fundraising based. So I didn't do really any traveling or teaching with that title. I am the first out non-lesbian and the first out genderqueer and the first out polyamorous person to ever actually hold Ms. New Mexico Pride title. With the New Mexico Pride title, the rules were pretty strict. If you were a female running as a female, or a male running as a female, you had to wear a formal ball length, like floor length gown in the formal wear competition. And we advocated to have the rules changed for female running as female, so you could wear a tuxedo as well, which opened up the competition, not just for feminine identified people, but also for butches and every other flavor of gender. And for that title, instead of just using my name, Julian Wolf, I ran as Prince Julian, partially to acknowledge the genderqueerness, but also to kind of give Albuquerque Pride Incorporated a little bit of a buffer between me as an adult educator and out kinky person, and me as a person that was performing Pride duties, since it's a family-friendly event.
That's a complicated situation.
I don't know if it was that complicated. It didn't take a lot of advocating with the board, but I felt it was important because, particularly in the gay women's community, there are a lot of people that don't wear dresses. And I don't think it's fair to limit somebody that might otherwise be an excellent representative who identifies and presents as female to floor-length gowns. And I did wear tall patent leather white boots and a fur with my tuxedo, just to be clear. But I am a very effeminate, very not your traditional butch presenting type of person. I take my masculinity seriously, but I'm a lot more like David Bowie than, say, The Rock.
I believe you've used the term gentleman dandy.
Yes, absolutely. I identify really strongly as a gentleman, and I frequently present as a dandy. And in some of my educational classes and also a column that I have on Fearless Press, I use that term dandy for myself quite a bit.
Could you explain dandy for our listeners?
Oh, absolutely. A dandy, traditionally, is someone who takes a lot of care in their appearance and generally presents themselves as aristocratic, whether or not they are. Now, it used to specifically be related to the Bohemian movement back in the day. And so you've got dandies like Beau Brummel and Walt Whitman and all of those people. But the really neat thing about modern dandyism is you get people a few years back like Fred Astaire, but characters on TV like Barney from, you know, How I Met Your Mother. And there's a whole movement of female dandies and still male dandies. And it's kind of just giving that extra amount of care and consideration into your appearance, but also how you present yourself. Like, for example, I know which fork to use, and that sort of thing, kind of having that whole aristocratic air, even though I tell you now, this prince is a pauper.
You live in the real world.
Very much so. And I've been very blessed in a lot of ways, being able to do the things that I do. But I frequently have struggles making ends meet.
That's a real world that we all live in, or everybody that I know. But you are a diverse person. You are a performance artist and entertainer?
Absolutely. That's everything from leather fantasies, which again, I've been performing since my very first leather event. And that was an easy transition from when I was in church in junior high and high school. I ran the church's drama troupe. Really, really similar what we were doing, sketches at church, and then what we do at leather events. You know, short stories set to music, very similar. But like last year, I'm very, very excited about this. I ran my first start to finish cabaret. We had live music, live performances. We didn't use anything canned. And it was very successful. It was partially a fundraiser for the Unseen Gallery. And it was a micro venue. But we had a really good time. And I co-produced that with the guy I'm in a band with and two of my other friends. And I'm planning on, we're doing more performances similar to that this year.
So you're a musician also?
I wouldn't label myself that way. But I do a lot of vocals, and I'm also, at this point, I guess I can say I'm a lyricist, since we've performed songs that I wrote the words to and helped the melody with in front of live audiences more than twice now.
Where in the world do you find the energy and the time at? I have no idea, but we appreciate the fact you do. But one of your passions is education, and that's been since day one in your journey. What's it going on with you now in the education realm? You're very involved there.
Very much so. I've loved being involved with education from both aspects of a presenter and as an educator myself. I've been really working on upping my game the last couple of years. I've been really honing my classes instead of just giant broad topics to really specific things so we can really get in there and learn, you know, in a short amount of time. I've been working on involving the members that come to my classes more so that way we can address specific issues and concerns, because the same class in your town is going to look different than the same class in my town, because different regions, different areas have different concerns and different, you know, issues. So that's part of what I've been doing. I've also been doing more multimedia stuff. That doesn't always work out, because if you have problems with the tech, then you wind up having lame tech. But so many people learn different ways. There's audio learners, visual learners, kinesthetic learners, and I've really been trying to make sure that I've got something for everyone so that the information can be most easily processed in every single one of my classes. I've also been able to branch out and do a little bit more on the spiritual side, which is cool, and more kink stuff for vanilla people, which is pretty cool.
So education is something that you're involved with on a weekly basis in some form or fashion, in putting together classes or fine-tuning or syllabuses or just reflecting on better ways to present and bring material to the student.
Absolutely. And I think that if you're not working pretty much constantly, then that's kind of an issue. I'm a real believer in making sure that your information is up to date, knowing what you're talking about, and also only speaking about things you're passionate about. Several years ago, I had to stop teaching wax play classes for a while because I had done nothing but wax play classes for so long, it stopped being fun, and that reflects poorly on me as an educator if I'm not just ecstatic about whatever subject I'm going to talk about. So I took that away for a little bit and then added it back once I kind of got my drive back. But I also didn't want to be seen as a one-trick pony.
There is a cycle I see in the community where some topic will come in and be the rage, and that's all we see for a period of time. And right now, rope is a big one in our area, and single tails seem to be a hot topic.
Sounds like I need to come to your area.
We'd be glad to have you. Well, I was doing research on you. I saw a paper that you had written and taken an application that we need to better value and care for our community educators, and that this means taking care of them so that they can devote themselves to presenting quality classes, and that our community should be more willing to pay for the education that they're getting. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. And I really believe this is an opinion from somebody that is greatly underneath the poverty line. I think that when you're bringing somebody in to teach, just because they like something is not necessarily the person you need to have them teaching on that subject. Lots of times we bring in people from the region, from out of state or whatever, because they're a quote unquote name or celebrity, and then completely neglect everyone else that's there. When I first started teaching regionally, I usually was paying out of pocket. So I was driving anywhere from 2 to 7 hours. I was usually being put up by a local person in the community. But for the most part, I was feeding myself. If I brought somebody, I was taking care of them. And then on occasion, I've had people say, come teach at our event. You only have to also volunteer 6 more hours. When I was younger, sometimes I would go ahead and do that. But if you want me to be able to give you my all for a class, I'm going to need time to prepare that. Of course, I'm writing the classes in advance, but there's still, you know, amount of calm. I need to be well rested, all of these sorts of things. It's kind of silly. I've also been recruited. Hey, Julian, come teach at our event. It's a great event. We'd love to have you. Great, I say. And they say, cool. So when are you going to fly out? And I say, excuse me. and there are people that do have the means to do that. We shouldn't be starving people or making them choose between, you know, their day jobs or, you know, not being able to take time because it would cost so much to go do this if they really know what they're talking about, if their opinions really matter. I've certainly had events go above and beyond and take excellent care of me, but I've also been to events where I've seen primarily local presenters teach, but they had very little idea of what they were talking about or straight up gave misinformation. But the reason they got the gig is they knew the right person.
I'm involved in the pagan community also, and some of the same problems that you're describing we see in the pagan community also in quality presentations and quality educators coming to events is their money just is not freely available, whether for whatever reason, to compensate them the way that they deserve to be compensated.
And the funny thing is lots of times that money might be available, but it's not prioritized. I was in an event once where they prioritized a snack bar, which wound up not being used over, you know, bringing in somebody or being able to even give the prisoners, you know, snacks, quite frankly. Lots of times you get a gift bag or a, you know, a hospitality bag as a prisoner, which can absolutely be a lifesaver because particularly if you're teaching more than one class in a day, you don't have time to take an hour to go eat at the restaurant. And some of us don't have the money to go eat at the restaurant. But I think we need to prioritize the quality of our educators over maybe the bouncy castle. And I love bouncy castles, but I think that's something we need to look at as a community.
I sat for an unnamed national organization, and they gave us zero budget for the presenters. We could comp their attendance fees, which I thought was just a natural thing, and they gave us such a limited budget on our keynote presenters even that it was embarrassing for us to proceed with this. We barely had money for airfare for our keynote presenters. It was really frustrating.
And I just think that's sad. I actually had the honor of giving a keynote presentation at an event in Arizona that it was only the second or third year that they had done it. Very small event. And they prioritized their presenters. They had less presenters so that they could have higher quality presenters. And they absolutely took care of me the year I gave the keynote. It's called Beyond Closed Doors. That I did a topic on old school, new generation. I talked about people, you know, I come from an older school than the people that came to our community through FetLife, but how that doesn't make me any better or worse than anybody else. It's just a fact about my history. But they absolutely were able to take care of me in ways that bigger events that are sponsoring wine nights, wine and chocolate nights, but they can't compensate a presenter beyond letting them in for free and maybe letting their partner in for free if their partner is demobotomy.
If they're part of the presentation. Question though, how do we build up a quality pool of local presenters when we have such a disagreement over what this kink thing is all about and how we do it? How do we vet presenters?
Well, I've learned that while our opinions in the greater sense do frequently vary, having an understanding, particularly regionally, of what's okay and what isn't is important. One of the most important things we've done with the NCSF has been the work towards defining consent, and that's been most important, particularly in legal situations. But hopefully we all have an understanding of, you know, yes meaning yes and no meaning no. And then kind of going from there. I do think we need to let new presenters in. I do think we need to give people opportunities. But particularly when I was running TNG, and I stepped down before I was 30, which was my promise I made when I started the group in 2002, was I had a conversation with anybody that wanted to teach. People would come to me, hey, Julian, I really want to teach about, let me make something up, about floggers. And I would say, great, what do you want to talk about? And we'd have a conversation. There's a story, and I'll try to be ambiguous. I've worked all over the place in my region, so hopefully this is ambiguous enough. There was a teacher that the way they taught flogging, I'm using the term teacher loosely, and this was at a sex shop somewhere in the tri-state area. The way they taught flogging, and I'm not kidding, is after people checked in for the class, they handed all of the masculine-presenting people floggers.
Masculine.
And said, masculine-presenting, they handed everyone that looked butch or was a man a flogger and said, cool, go ahead and swing this on your partner's back until you get comfortable. That's how they started the class.
That's scary.
That's a warm-up.
A flogging 101 class when some of these people had never held a toy before. That's not cool. I also know of a couple of rope places where they assume if you've got, you know, that if you're female, that you're going to be bottoming, and they say, hey, go find somebody to tie you up. That is not a 101. That's dangerous, and that's not acceptable.
Well, that's not acceptable on so many levels. The sexism is just, it's horrifying.
Oh, it's absolutely. And the person in this case that was teaching the flogging class, for example, is a female person, but is very committed to the butch femme dynamic and assumes butch being the dominant and femme being the submissive. And that's just not okay. And is it sexy? Yes. Have I had some very girly girl submissives before and bottoms? Absolutely. They're badasses. Why wouldn't I?
You got good taste.
Oh, yeah. That should not be acceptable. And instead of us saying, oh, well, it's not our class, we should let them do their own thing, people need to have enough courage and enough care for their people to stand up and say, no, that's not cool. Part of my identification as a prince and a gentleman and all of that sort of stuff is the fact that I feel I have a personal responsibility to my people. My people, in most cases, being other kinky people, other queer people, other people that are in the alternative scene, as it were. And we have to be able to stand up for ourselves or there's almost no point. The other option is step back and do nothing and play alone, but you're not going to meet new people that way.
And you don't develop skills because you're not exposed to any new sensory input to even consider new possibilities.
Exactly. So I thought I hated caning my first 7 or 8 years I was in the kink scene. I thought caning was the worst, most terrible thing you could possibly do. I didn't understand why anybody would like it. And then I got out of my region, negotiated a very, you know, loose-knit scene with someone, and was not tied down, could have, you know, walked away, etc. When this person pulled out a cane, I didn't run. I knew I could say no at any point. And they started caning me, and guess what? Caning is awesome. Nobody in my area we're teaching anyone how to do it right.
The events they go to are regionally based, and they don't have reasons to travel outside the regions, so they aren't exposed to new ideals in many cases.
Right. And that's one of the reasons, because, of course, there's cost prohibitive. You asked me earlier how I have the time. I'm child-free. I don't have any non-human pets. That really opens up my schedule. That's why I think organizations like Kink Academy are so important.
And you're a presenter with Kink Academy and Passionate You also, aren't you?
It's all under the same umbrella. And if y'all have it, you can look it up. It's Princess Callie. She has Passionate You, kinkacademy.com, and also, I believe she also owns Beyond 50 Shades. And what she has been doing for years is getting quality, vetted presenters to teach good topics in short form for really affordable. You can get a year membership for less than most places charge for a day-long event. And I think that's important. I use that as a resource. Fortunately, as one of the educators, I kind of get a membership when I'm honing specific skill sets like my rope or wanting to learn a little bit more about, I did my pony play research on King's Academy, or want to get somebody else's perspective on role play, because I don't just want to offer my opinion on everything. And of course, you always credit people if you do quote anyone. I think stuff like that is really important. Also, some people are shy and don't want their first experience to be going to some class or some workshop or some event.
I see the brick and mortar community, the quote real life community, not being as embracive of Kink Academy as an education option as those solitaires out there practicing in a much smaller space. How do we overcome this?
How do we overcome the people who think we need dungeons and clubs exclusively instead of like the internet?
Has a teaching venue that in their local clubs, instead of going to Kink Academy and getting quality vetted education, that they turn to a internet source. How do we overcome this?
Well, the hard thing about new anything is so many people don't like change. As individuals, we might like change, but as groups, we tend to be really scared of it. I think that brick and mortar, I am here with you, I'm talking to you, we're doing hands-on with supervision, is incredibly important. It's incredibly vital, and it also doesn't work for everybody. I am leather queer 24/7. This is what I do. This is how I live my life. That's not an option for everybody. And I do want people who just want to do rope or just want to do spanking or just want to do Lolita dress up with their sex life to have resources that they, where they don't have to go to a club, because they don't need to meet everybody else. Maybe they're only doing this with a specific partner, or in some cases, just by themselves. I think that it's all of the things that are important. I've been following Read About Sex. He helps train presenters and also writes about sex and everything else. I try to keep kind of abreast of that. There's even radio stations and all of these other places that are exploring all these different things. And I think getting information from multiple different sources and then making educated decisions on how you think things roll is a really healthy and good way to do stuff. No one person is the sole and only expert in the whole universe, and only their opinion matters. And that's just not a reality. And I always tell people in my one-on-one classes, if anyone tells you, and this includes online, in an essay, in real life, in a dungeon, at a munch, I'm the only person you need to talk to. I've got this down. You don't need to go to anybody else. Or I'm the only person who's an expert. You need to run away from that person.
The word expert is often a scary term when somebody applies it to themselves.
That's true.
It's like calling yourself a master.
Yeah. I have had people use that term in reference to me, and the first time it happened, I almost refused to continue the work. It freaked me out. And I've realized now in a couple of things, I have more expertise than most people do, because I'm very specialized on some of the things that I'm into and have put hundreds and hundreds of hours of work and research and life experience into those things.
But the difference is somebody applied it to you. You didn't apply it to yourself.
That is very, very true.
The self-anointed expert is the one I find that you need to be much more cautious of than the expert.
Yes.
That is being praised by their peers for their skill, ability, knowledge. You have to have some baseline to trust. And I think your peers is always the first people we turn to for feedback and input is those around us.
Yeah, and I came to being where I'm at in some ways with a lot of hesitation. I actually had a fellow prisoner at one point at an event. It was one of my first big events. I've traveled a lot of places in the U.S., and I've been to Canada once, and I made some comment about not wondering if it was okay if I went somewhere. And they were friendly enough with me that they basically did the verbal equivalent of smacking me upside the head and said, Julian, you're presenters. And then I realized that I needed to go ahead and allow myself, you know, to use the presenters lounge and all this other stuff that I used to not because I couldn't even believe I was there.
You have arrived.
Yeah, not everyone needs to have that level of unrealistic humbleness. I'm one of the oldest active members of the community in Albuquerque in a lot of ways. I've been active in leather and in kink since 99 with only about 6 month break. So I've had people before, particularly when I started TNG, try to tell me that maybe we shouldn't have a group for younger people because they're not as experienced. And I had to look at them and be like, hey, so you came out 2 years ago. I've been out for 5. Okay, somebody do the math for me. Am I at 14 years now or 15?
You're at 16.
Oh, dear. So for somebody who's as young as I am, I just turned 35 in March. That's a lot of time doing this pretty much consistently. But I have completely different life experience, of course, than somebody that came out at 35 versus somebody that came out, you know, before. And now with things like FetLife and the internet, there are people that have been in doing research since they were kids in this stuff that I only dreamt about when I was younger.
But likewise, we have people coming out in their 50s now.
Oh, in 60s.
And they are just entering, and I see a definite problem with them gaining education. It's just the dynamics are very odd to have a 60-year-old, 50-year-old novice sitting in a class with 20-year-old novices. It's just a cultural issue there that it's a little hard to understand, because we look up to age automatically has experience and knows more. And that's not always the case.
And like, I was not uncomfortable. The woman that picked me up at the bar was 14 years older than me. I've never been uncomfortable with people that were one or two or three generations older than me. So I personally didn't need TNG from a social perspective at all. But a lot of people, particularly in Albuquerque, had tried to come out and then left because the only groups in town were people that were at least 30 or 40. And they didn't feel coming out and trying to get naked in front of people their parents or their grandparents' age. I think making sure that you've got organizations like TNG, like Newbie Munches and whatnot, is important. Until you get comfortable, you can be among your physically aged peers if that's what you need to do for you. Now, I also always stressed when I was running TNG, and again, I stepped down in 2010 when I was turning 30, I always stressed that we had volunteerism and we always worked with the community at large, because I wanted people to get over it. And I wanted the older people to understand that we were viable parts of the community, but also for the younger people to get that not everybody who's your mom or your dad's age is scary.
Have you been in a situation with parents and children in the same dungeon? It's a very unique situation.
Yeah, it is a little bit. I actually ran a BDSM gender sexuality 101 in the basement of a church once, so that parents and kids could sit and learn about that stuff without having to ask each other questions. They could talk to me. And that's handy. And I actually have been in a situation. I'm part of the Dragon Clan based out of Arizona. One of the matriarch and patriarch's kids came to an event when she was much, you know, plenty old enough to do it. And they actually thought it was funny to get her to mess with me. So I've actually had them take advantage of it in a rather amusing way. But it is an interesting situation. And I know brothers and sisters that are out in the same community. And you have to set your boundaries and you have to set your limits. And then, you know, personally, and then follow those to make it not awkward.
I have seen them literally put it on the calendar. Mom can go to the dungeon on this weekend, but next weekend is for the kids. And I think we're actually getting ready, probably another decade, that we'll have 3 generations involved. And that's where you're going to get interesting scheduling-wise.
Yeah, very likely.
What do you see in the future for education?
I hope we start seeing more professionals being treated like professionals. I hope we see us taking care of our quality educators while bringing up our newer presenters and newer educators to actually give quality work. I would like to see a conference where I know for a fact that everyone there has been vetted and I'm going to get a good class. That's what I would like to see in the future. And it's been happening less, but I have been to an event that was labeled as an international event and had to walk out of the class because what the presenter was talking about was not only wrong, it was dangerous. So, and that was several years ago. So what I would like to see is, particularly in this age where you can do a phone interview in advance, most people have Skype, most people have whatever, that we talk to our people and we know in advance who we're getting, what we're getting, and then we take care of them. And now I do not expect to get, you know, presents and everything else when I go present, but, you know, making sure I have a safe ride from the airport is nice. Making sure that, you know, I've got a connection to whoever the organizers are in case there's a problem. Little things like that are great, because having to go in and fight to get your class to go smoothly is, perhaps we don't have our priorities in the right place. The dungeon can't be awesome if nobody knows what they're doing.
So we have a ways to go, but you think we are making some headway towards this future?
In a lot of areas, I really think we are. And I certainly am working towards that.
Julian, it's been great having you with us today.
It's been an honor to be here. I really appreciate it.
We always are happy to get national voices, and I believe yours is a national voice that's going to be around for quite a few more years with us.
I certainly hope so. I've been eating right and working out, so y'all should get another few decades out of me.
All right.
Two, I am counting on at least another 5 decades.
I hope so. I'm really into wheelchair bondage. We'll make this happen.
There you go. Julian, thank you. You've been wonderful tonight.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to episode 76 of The Kinky Cast. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and all our kinky crew, I'm Max. See you next week when we have Dating Safety with Scarlett Wild.